All right, now this is the reason I'm here. I think head and heart have to go together. You cannot let your head race ahead of your heart, and you cannot let your heart race ahead of your head. Your heart has to be grounded, and your head has to be practical, has to be able to meet people's needs. Now, having said that, why are we here? We're here because there is a huge attack on the church. Now, you see something up there on the screen that you know about, but there's four other things that are breaking in the next few weeks. One's already been on television. Another one is the subject of a two-hour special Sunday night, I think on the National Geographic Channel. Others are going to be breaking in the next few days on Dateline, on Good Morning America. And every one of them is going to claim something that the Da Vinci Code claims. Here's what they all have in common. Jesus is not divine. Here's what else they all have in common. Jesus did not rise from the dead. We saw one of the books just came out, I think, this weekend. We saw it in the airport bookstore today. I've got to go in a week to film six television specials. We do six of them back to back, myself and another historical Jesus guy, because we think this is going to be a real threat to the church. Okay, now, Da Vinci Code is a what? What kind of a book is it? What is it?
Fiction.
It's fiction. It says right on their cover, a novel. But I'm going to tell you something. It upsets a lot of Christians. Because I don't want to put you guys down. I tell my classes this. And then an article just came out in the secular paper just a couple weeks ago and said this is what the research shows. And it goes like this. Your generation is not, we're talking real general trends, right? We're not putting anybody down. But your generation is a touchy-feely generation and a good electronic generation, but it's not a reading and studying generation. And because people don't read and study, in fact, you want to hear something sobering, in a recent survey, 50% of college graduates cannot read, or if they can read, they cannot read anything beyond something at a much lower level, like they can read Reader's Digest. 50% of college grads. And only 25% of college grads are equipped to digest anything with any meat. This is a recent educational survey, nothing to do with religion. So Da Vinci comes out, and I'm telling you, I get calls all over the country. Christians do this kind of stuff. Pastors will call me and say, I got people not coming back to church. And when I say, why? Why aren't you coming? They'll say, I always thought something was wrong, and now I know what it is. I say, dude, that's a novel. Yeah, but, you know, he's kind of saying where my heart is. Fine. Who cares where your heart is? The question is, what's the data say? And so Da Vinci is cutting people up. You know, according to one estimate, how many people do you think have read this book? According to one estimate, 100 million people have read this book. And they're ignoring Christ because Da Vinci says, and doesn't Dan Brown say at the beginning of the book that everything in this book is fact? It says that. In fact, if any of you brought the book here for any reason, all you gotta do is turn past the title page and it's right there. It's fact. In fact, in an interview a long time ago, he was interviewed by a major talk show, and they asked him, if this wasn't a novel, if it was a history book, how would it be different? And he said, it really wouldn't be any different. Well, you don't have any data. But I'm telling you, folks, if this is throwing people off the tracks, wait till you see the stuff that's coming in the next few days. There's going to be a huge assault on the church. There's a major archaeologist who's going to claim that Mary was raped and that Jesus had a father and he was a Roman soldier. And they know where he's buried. They have to claim like this. The book that just came out on the stands today claimed they have a document written by Jesus. I was laughing about this over dinner with Andrew. It's like, how would you know a document by Jesus if you had one in your hand? How would you know that? Well, this guy says, well, it has to be Jesus. Just look at it. Sorry, I don't know what Jesus' handwriting looks like, you know. But they claim they found a document, and the document disappeared, I think they claim. In other words, not there to check out. And in this document, Jesus tells us that he didn't die on the cross, and he's not the Son of God, and he didn't rise from the dead. That story just broke this week. And we really need to know what the answers are. Okay? So tomorrow morning we do the heart, but tonight we want to talk about the head. All right? We want to answer some challenges, and I'm going to throw some other things in as we go. Da Vinci is easy because it's a novel, but keep in mind the refutations I'm going to mention, because the refutations for Da Vinci will work on the other treatments as well. Andrew, how long should we go for this first one? I just want to kind of time my comments here. For this first one? So if I go till 8 o'clock or a few minutes after, we're fine? Okay. Well, there's a lot of stuff. This presentation has more data than the second one does. The second one is about half the length. So what we thought what we'd do is I'll work through this first one, give you guys a break. We'll put the second one up. The second one is on Scripture and on Mary. Questions about Mary. You know, was Jesus married? Was Mary his wife? Did they have children? Scripture and Jesus' family are the second study. But there's a lot of material up here. And if you get this stuff down, you'll be able to answer most of these general kinds of questions. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. This is Da Vinci Code, and this part is part one on Jesus Christ. All right, here's that page right inside, and I'm quoting Dan Brown. Fact. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. And it's the page after the title page. So you hit this, and you think, wow, this guy's done some historical research. He can back all this stuff up historically, to which the answer is, doesn't work. And we'll see. All right, let's move on. Brown. Now, Teabing is one of the main characters in the book. Teabing is a professor, and Brown mouths his ideas through Teabing. Teabing's not the only one, but here's one thing Teabing says. At the Council of Nicaea, which is 325 AD, Constantine upgraded Jesus' status almost four centuries after Jesus' death. Constantine upgraded Jesus' status. What do you mean upgraded? Well, he wasn't divine before that, and now he's divine. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at the next one. Until that moment in history, Jesus was a mortal prophet. A great and powerful man, mind you, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. But at Nicaea, his teaching was changed to his divinity because of a relatively close vote. Okay, what's he trying to say? Here's some of the things we'll put right on the table. Jesus was a man until 325. And at 325, they made a god out of him. Now, do your math. If Jesus died about 30 AD, and Nicaea's 325, they're saying he wasn't declared to be God for 300 years. Right? You all with me? 300 years before he's declared to be God. Further, why was he made God? Because they took a vote at Nicaea, and the vote was really, really close. That's what he said. I mean, about 300 people were there, and they did some voting. So let's just say, if it's really, really close, what would the score be? 160 to 140? Would that be a close vote? Yeah. It'd be pretty close, out of 300. But let's see. Let's see if these things are facts. Now keep in mind what we're after. He wasn't declared God. Nobody believed he was God for 300 years. Constantine made him God. They took a vote. He barely made it, but he made it. All right, how do we know Jesus is deity? Now, here's the claim. He wasn't God before 300 A.D. All right, let's take a look. Now, let me share with you a principle. It's kind of a heady principle, but I think you guys are going to be able to track with me. We do this in grad school. So if you do this, if you pick up the principle tonight, you'll be way ahead of the ballgame. Whenever I go out and debate, let me tell you the number one objection I have on state university campuses. I was at Stanford last year. I was at Oxford and Cambridge last year. I'll tell you the number one objection I hear. It goes like this. You want me to believe the man. The man's in the book. Well, I'll tell you what. I don't believe the book, so I don't believe the man. That's the objection. Now, it's a pretty heady objection. Now, I'm not going to put anybody in the spot, but let me reframe that. And I'm going to ask in a second, I'm just curious, how many of you think you could answer this guy's question? I think the average Christian, honestly, is not equipped to answer this question. Let me give you the question again. I'll paraphrase it. The guy's basically saying, You want me to believe Jesus? Yeah. And the record of Jesus in the New Testament? Yeah. Well, let me tell you something. I don't believe the New Testament, so therefore I don't believe Jesus. Don't believe your book, so don't talk to me about the man. Now, I will not put you on the spot, all right? I'll take you at your word. I'm curious. How many of you know where you would start with a Stanford, Oxford, or Cambridge University student who gave you that objection? How many of you think you know where to go? I see three hands in the room, four hands in the room, and two of them are the Oates brothers. That's cheating, isn't it? Well, I know some of you are probably real humble, and you're wondering what to say. But I'm going to introduce a principle, and my students will know this is the minimal facts argument. I used to call it the core facts argument in the old days. But the minimal facts argument, and it's a heads I win, tails you lose argument. Right? So either way, Christians win the argument. How do you pull that off? Because I'm only going to use texts, I'm only going to use verses that critics will allow me to use. What kind of critics? You mean guys who are like sort of borderline Christians, but they're a little bit critical? No. How about atheists who teach New Testament in state universities? Will that be critical enough for you? I'll use verses that they will generally allow. I'm going to use their text. Now here's a principle that almost nobody understands. I have to do this over and over again with my graduate students for them to get the point. Maybe my fault. Maybe I'm not explaining it the right way. Only on secular campuses and in high schools will people ever say to you, I don't accept the book, so I don't accept the man. That's kind of a lay level kind of thing. Scholars will always let you use the New Testament. They just won't let you use your favorite passages. Their principle is you can only use texts that stand up to criticism. Now, we can explain this, or you can push this during the Q&A if you want to. But they'll only let you use verses for which we have backup. They'll never tell you, you can't use any verses in the New Testament. Nobody will say that. So I'm only going to use verses. To make my point, I'm going to argue that Jesus, it did not take 300 years for Jesus to be proclaimed deity. That's what I'm going to argue. It did not take 300 years. And I'm going to use verses to show you he was deity from the very beginning, but I'm only going to use verses that critics respect. Does that make sense? Now remember the charge. He was only a man until Emperor Constantine came along, 300, 325. He was only a man for 300 years, and then one day they decided to take a vote, and they go, wow, we got a god here, which is kind of what they did with the Roman emperors. So that would be familiar to a Roman crowd. All right, I'm going to use some verses here, and you tell me. Remember what Dan Brown said, Jesus was a mortal man until 325 AD. You tell me if these verses sound like Jesus is a mortal man. I'm going to use critics' verses. All right, let's take a look. If you ask me, how can I show the deity of Jesus in the Gospels? There's a lot of ways to do it, but I'm only going to use two. I'm going to use two titles, Son of Man and Son of God. Now, of those two titles, I'll bet you'd say, Son of God, I can understand how Son of God is deity. But I don't understand how Son of Man is deity. Pastors sometimes in pulpits will say this, Son of God is Jesus' divine nature, and Son of Man is his human nature. After all, Son of Man, that's human nature. Again, the answer to that is, not biblically. Son of Man is as lofty a category as Son of God is. That might surprise you. Son of Man is a title of deity. Now let me tell you some background. If you have your Bibles and you want to check this out. In the Old Testament, by the way, Son of Man can mean a man. It's a plain old man. Son of Man can also mean a prophet. Ezekiel is called the Son of Man almost 100 times. But in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, there's a very special use of Son of Man. Daniel 7, 13 and 14. Daniel says, I looked and behold, in the night visions, one came from the Ancient of Days. Now the Ancient of Days is who? God. And one came from the son of one came from the Ancient of Days, and he was a Son of Man. You think, all right, so there's a man, who God sends? I don't think so. Listen to what happens, and you tell me if this guy is a man. By the way, this is a good verse to use with Jews, for example, who say that the Old Testament does not present anybody else besides the Father as God. I mean, for example, Isaiah 9:6 says the Messiah will be mighty God, everlasting Father. Micah 5:2, you see that on Christmas cards. On Micah 5:2, the Messiah is going forth as from everlasting. What man is from everlasting? And in Genesis chapter 18, Abraham walks and talks with a man, and the man is called Jehovah. But yet, no man's ever seen God, right? The Old Testament says that very clearly. So who's this God? Who's Jehovah who's walking and talking with Abraham? A lot of indications in the Old Testament. But Daniel 7, 13 and 14 is one of the major ones. Now, Ancient of Days is God. But who's the Son of Man? He comes from God. He sets up a kingdom on earth. And some translations, most translations will say, all the nations of the world serve him. But a couple translations say, all the nations of the world worship him. Worship a man? That's not right. Why do most of the translations, though, say serve? Well, in the Greek Old Testament, anybody know what the Greek Old Testament's called? The Old Testament's written almost totally in Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, but there is a Greek version that was translated before Christ, and you can still buy it in your bookstores. Anybody know the name? The Septuagint, that's correct. In the Greek, for that passage in Daniel 7, the Greek word is latruo. And latruo, which usually means serve, all the nations served him. But in all the instances in the Bible, about 150 times, in every instance but one, the type of serving is service in a temple. It means serving in a worshipful context. That's why some passages say they worship the Son of Man. Who's the Son of Man who sets up God's kingdom and he's worshipped or served in a religious manner? Who's this man? Well, that's Jesus' favorite name for himself. He calls himself Son of Man. And here's something odd. Nobody else called Jesus the Son of Man in any of the Gospels. No epistle calls Jesus the Son of Man. They didn't know what to do with this. It's a very odd phrase, but Jesus used it of himself more than 50 times in the Gospels. Let's just take a look at two of them. Mark chapter 2, 1 through 12. You know the story very well, I think. Jesus is in a house, and while he's preaching, people can't get close to him because of the people, and they cut a hole in the tiles, right? You know the story? And they lower a man who was paralyzed, and Jesus touched him, and he said, "Son, your sins are forgiven you." And the Jewish leaders immediately cried out, "That's blasphemy! Men can't forgive sins. That's blasphemy. Who do you think you are?" And Jesus said, "So that you know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins." Now, before I even go any further, he said, "You can't forgive sins. You're a man." He said, "Well, you know, you're kind of right there. So that you know that I can forgive sins." And then he says, "Son, take up your bed and walk." And he heals him. The point there is that the miracle evidences the message. The fact that Jesus could heal him shows that the Son of Man could forgive sins. Now you say, well, this guy you're talking to at Stanford or Oxford, he doesn't believe Jesus healed the man, does he? Well, first of all, I'll maybe surprise you. Do you know that most critics today concede that Jesus was a miracle worker? Most critics concede that. But you're missing my point if that's what you think I'm after here. I'm not talking about the miracle. I'm talking about what the Son of Man does. They say, "You can't do that. The Son of Man can't, men can't forgive sins." And Jesus said, "I can, and I'll heal them to prove it." So the Son of Man forgives sins? All right. Now, in a minute, I want to talk about Son of God. But this text, let's just all jump in here. I think this is the best text, Mark 14, best text of the New Testament where Jesus is called deity. Now, before I do that, If somebody asks you, what's your favorite text that shows the deity of Christ? Just anybody have a favorite? What text would you use with a skeptic who wants to know, did Jesus claim to be deity? Pardon? All right, transfiguration would show what? That Jesus is not an ordinary man. But you know what? Moses and Enoch are both there, and they're not God. But the transfiguration would be a hint that he is somebody out of the ordinary, for sure. When you see this, when you see your buddy all kind of lit up here, that's kind of a hint something's going on. Jesus said, I am. Where does he say that? Well, in John 8:58, before Abraham was, I am. That's a lot of people's favorite verse. Here's another one. I and the Father are one, John 10. You know what's strange when people usually give me verses? Christians almost always use the Gospel of John. Critics almost never use the Gospel of John. But I think the strongest verse is this one. And let me kind of paint the scene here for you. Mark 14. If you saw the Passion, Mel Gibson does a really good job with this text. You know, it's in Aramaic, right? But then they give that subscript. The high priest, well, let's back up. They're trying to nail Jesus, and they want him dead. The Talmud, by the way, a Jewish writing, the Talmud says that they wanted to stone him, because that's how Jews killed heretics. And so they were bringing witnesses forward. Do you remember this? Oh, he said he'd destroy the temple. He said he'd do this. He said he'd do that. And they can't make anything stick. And so the high priest comes forward. And I get the idea, the high priest, this was a mano a mano thing. The high priest, you get the feeling from the text because of the way he acts. It's sort of like, all you witnesses, nobody could nail this Galilean carpenter. Back off. I send guys out, he whips them in a debate. I'll show you how it's done. High priest is talking. And he walks up to Jesus and he says, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Let me translate that. Are you the Messiah, the Son of God? Are you the Messiah, the Son of God? And Jesus says in the Greek, ego eimi. Anybody know what that is? I am. Not before Abraham was I am, because that one takes a little bit of thought. Just flat out. Are you, who do you think you are? Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? I want to hear it from your own lips. Ego in me. And henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds, seated on God's right hand. And the high priest tears his clothes, which is indicative of a formal declaration of blasphemy. You know, if this were today, here's what the priest, in those days you tear your clothes. Here's what the high priest would have done today. Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Ego me. And henceforth you'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. Which, by the way, in the Bible, only God comes on the clouds. But the real killer, besides the ego me, besides coming on the clouds, the real killer is, I will be on God's right hand. David, does it say sitting or standing? Sitting. I am co-regent on my Father's throne. You crossed the line. So instead of tearing your garment, here's what the high priest would have done today. Yes. Got him. You losers, go home. He says in the next verse, we don't need any more witnesses. What do you guys think? I think I heard blasphemy. What did the rest of you guys think? Everyone goes, yeah, blasphemy. It's the same guys on the old westerns, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, that when they say, let's string them up, and everyone goes, yeah, they pay the guys $10 and kick them off the set. That's who the guys who were in that room that night, and they're all going, yeah, string them up. But the high priest did what he needed to. He goes, yes, got him.